Welcome to the Science Podcast for April 26, 2013. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Carrie Klein. This week, social networking in whales, how a pulsar sheds light on relativity, and an inside look at tuberculosis in North Korea.
What makes North Korea stand out especially is that unlike nearly all other countries with a high TB burden, it doesn't have a big HIV/AIDS problem. The roots of the epidemic in North Korea are devastating famines from 1994 to 98.
Plus, a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org. This podcast is also sponsored by Audible.com, home to over 100,000 audiobooks.
The best way to find lunch in a strange city is to consult a map, an app, or even a stranger. What you wouldn't do is just follow your nose to suss out the best restaurant. We don't have the time or patience to figure out all things for ourselves. Learning from others is often the most efficient way to learn needed information. The question is, how many animals besides humans engage in this type of learning, and how much? I spoke with Luke Rendell about his study of how the cultural transmission of knowledge in humpback whales may help them get lunch in the most efficient manner possible.
We've been able to track the origin and spread of a novel feeding technique, which is termed lobtail feeding, this particular technique, in a natural population of humpback whales. And we've been able to show that its pattern of spread is strongly influenced by cultural transmission. That is, the learning of behavior from others rather than learning something individually on your own. To us, these results vividly illustrate how cultural transmission plays an important role in the spread of feeding behaviors in humpback whales, and that this kind of learning from others is likely to give these whales a powerful advantage in being able to adapt to new food sources and to changing ecological conditions.
So let's talk about your data set. It's pretty gigantic. Where did you get 27 years worth of whale observations?
It's an absolutely incredible data set. It contains over 70,000 sighting records from over 600 whales. And the existence of this data set is largely down to the dedication of one of the authors of our paper, Mason Weinrich, and his colleagues at the Whale Center of New England. So the data were collected by trained observers working as naturalists or interpreters on board whale watching vessels. So the Gulf of Maine is a very popular area for whale watching. Thousands of people every year go and see whales and dolphins there. And there can be up to half a dozen of these vessels spread across the Gulf on any one day. So they really represent a brilliant observation network. It's very sad that Mason himself can't talk to you about that because he's recovering from the effects of a stroke right now.
Oh, wow.
So we're all thinking of him at this time and kind of wishing him a speedy recovery. But the fact that we could do this study at all really is down to the work that he's put in over the last sort of 27 years.
All right. Well, in terms of these observations, they're about a type of feeding that's what you focus in on. How did this behavior itself become a target of the study?
Yeah, so this population has actually been studied since the mid-1970s. It's one of the first big whale populations that was extensively studied. And in 1980, during a kind of survey of feeding methods in which about 150 different whales were observed feeding across the Gulf of Maine, this new tactic called lobtail feeding was first noticed in a single individual in that study. And it was an elaboration of the kind of standard bubble feeding technique that the whales use, in which they dive down and blow clouds of bubbles underwater that act as a kind of net around shoals of prey. And then they then lunge through the net with their mouths open and catch a mouthful of water with the prey in it, which they then sort of filter out with their baleen. The addition of a lobtail, which is a term meaning just hitting the surface of the water with your tail before the diving, is what kind of made this technique stand out from what had gone before. It appears to function by creating a patch of kind of disturbed water at the surface, which we think probably helps in keeping the prey bunched up in some way. So like I say, this was first seen in 1980, and then the following year, 1981, five whales were seen doing it, and in subsequent years, more and more whales were sighted doing it. The Mason actually published a paper back in 1992 noting how the behavior appeared to be spreading. But it's only with kind of recent developments and more powerful analysis techniques that we've been able to show that that spread actually does rely on cultural transmission.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit about your technique. You used network analysis to tease apart different factors that may account for the transmission of this behavior. Can you describe how that would work?
Sure, yeah. So the analysis works by assuming that if lobtail feeding is learned from others, then the whales that hang out with more with others that are already doing it are more likely to pick it up themselves. Okay, so imagine you have a friend who likes to whistle really catchy tunes, and the more you hang out with her, the more likely it is you're going to end up whistling some of the same tunes, right? So network-based diffusion analysis, which we use, is a way to quantify how strong this kind of social effect must have been to explain the pattern of spread that we saw in the data. It allows us to kind of compare scenarios in which the network of social relationships has no effect on the spread of behavior with ones where it does, and then quantify how well each scenario fits the pattern we observed.
Your observations require that you recognize whales and whether or not they're associating with each other?
Yes, that's right. So part of what Mason and the Whale Center and Jenny Allen, who's the lead author of the paper and has worked with Mason for several years, they have a catalog that they take out with them, which lays out the identifying marks of each different whale in terms of pigmentation patterns on their tail and marks on their side and things like that. So they identify the animals in the field and take photographs to confirm. We could use this data to figure out what the social network was. The results of the analysis kind of reflect what we can see if we lay out the social network and mark the individuals on it according to whether they've ever been seen doing lobtail feeding or not. And we do this in figure 2 of our paper. If you look at that figure, you can see that the whales that are closer to the well-connected center of the network are much more likely to have learned the behavior. And we think this is because they will have had more opportunities to observe other whales lobtail feeding and so be more likely to pick it up for themselves than whales that are more peripheral to the network.
You also need to look at alternative explanations, like whether or not this is just a relationship between a mother and a child that's causing this to be transmitted. Can you talk about some of those alternative hypotheses?
Yeah, well, there are a number I'll try and go through. There are a few sort of quite simple ones, which were explanations which might suggest that what we saw was just an artifact, right? So one simple one is that we were just seeing the effects of our observation process. The more often a whale was seen, the more likely you would see it performing a particular behavior, mm-hmm. like lobtail feeding, and the more likely you'd be able to see it associating with others. But because the analysis allowed us to enter the number of sightings as a kind of predictor and therefore control for this effect, right? And so our social transmission effect remains even when we control for it. Another thing we wanted to rule out was something called homophily, which in this case would mean that lobtail feeding whales were more likely to hang out with each other after they've learned the behavior, right? And this would kind of create spurious relationships between the distribution of the behavior and the social network. So we controlled for this by doing another analysis which used only social network data gathered from before each whale was first seen doing the behavior. So if there was an effect of the social network, it could only have been working before the animal actually learned the behavior. So the analysis method is really powerful, I think, because it allows us to quantify the contributions of these various potential causes mm-hmm. for lobtail feeding to develop in individual whales. So like one of our predictors was whether an individual's mother was herself a lobtail feeder. Given that calves have on average, you know, 50% of their mother's genes, we would have expected this to be an important predictor if genetic factors were important. But it wasn't in our model, so we concluded that these factors were not important, that you couldn't explain this with a solely genetic cause. And then we were also interested in the ecological factors. Here it gets a bit more complicated because we actually suspect that lobtail feeding is linked to a switch of prey from herring, which crashed in the 1970s, to sand lance, which kind of went through a boom in the same time that this behavior was first seen. So we included research trawl data on sand lance abundance from research trawls in the Gulf of Maine for each year of the study, and we found that independently of the social effects, individuals were also more likely to be first seen lobtail feeding in years when sand lance were abundant, right? And so these two effects were combined to produce the spread that we observe, right? But because we could include and account for this effect in our analysis, we were then able to quantify the role of cultural transmission as well, right? So we found that models in which this social network did affect the spread of lobtail feeding fit the observed pattern far better. The weight of evidence was at 23 orders of magnitude greater for models with a cultural transmission effect than for models with no such effect. That's like the difference between the weight of a single person and the weight of the planet Earth.
Okay. All right. Well, how does this finding relate to what we know about whale songs? Are they shared in the same way?
Yeah, so the humpback song is an amazing example of cultural evolution. Every whale in a given breeding population sings the same song, and these songs change continuously. They incrementally evolve over the years, but everyone keeps up with the changes. But you also get this effect that's been documented by an Australian scientist called Mike Node, where entire populations undergo kind of revolutionary change, where they completely throw out their old song in favor of a new one. They don't make it up, it comes from another population, and for some reason this new song is so attractive they just throw it all out. And so Mike's kind of documented in the South Pacific these songs traveling from population to population, from Australia across to French Polynesia in these kind of cultural waves. Now, this is a slightly different learning mechanism, right? It's vocal learning, where they're learning sounds from hearing others produce them, than we think is responsible for the spread of lobtail feeding, where we don't actually know what the social learning mechanism is, but we know that it is social. But the essence is the same, right? They're learning it from right. each other.
So is this something that's been observed in other whales besides humpback whales?
No, this would be the first example I can think of where you have a kind of naturally occurring innovation and you're able to track its spread through time. Huh. We suspect that a lot of the behavioral variation that we see in whales and dolphins is a result of this kind of cultural transmission.
But it's hard to take a picture of that.
Yeah, exactly. It's really hard to show as conclusively as we've been able to hear that that's what's going on.
Okay. Well, Luke Rendell, thanks so much for talking with me.
No problem.
Luke Rendell and colleagues write about trends in humpback whale feeding in a report this week. Be sure to check out a companion report by Erica Vondewall and colleagues on cultural changes in monkey feeding patterns, and a related perspective by Franz DeWall, no relation, on animal conformists, all in this week's issue. Hey, podcast listeners. This week's show is sponsored by Audible, and there's a special deal being offered to our listeners. If you go to audiblepodcast.com/sciencemag, you can get a free audiobook of your choice.
And if you're having trouble deciding, let us make a few recommendations for you. A book that's on my list is The Social Conquest of Earth by Edward O. Wilson, who is, of course, one of the most prominent specialists in ant social behavior. But the book also provides a lot of insight into human social behavior. So what did you pick, Sarah?
On the same type of theme, I picked Animals Make Us Human by Temple Grandin. It's definitely a unique perspective on our relationship with animals.
Okay, lots of animals and creepy crawlies this week. So I hope you get a chance to check out these books and more from Audible. And don't forget, you can get a free download just for signing up at audiblepodcast.com/sciencemag. Albert Einstein published the general theory of relativity in 1916, and in the nearly 100 years since, it's been upheld by every test and experiment that we've tried. While the conditions we observe here on Earth aren't extreme enough to test the limits of general relativity, the bizarre and improbable phenomena we spot light years away in the cosmos might offer some assistance. Astronomer John Antoniadis spoke with me about a pulsar in an unusually compact binary star system that put general relativity to the test.
A pulsar is what is left over after a massive star 10 to 30 times the size of our sun collapses at the end of its lifetime. During this collapse, the outer layers of the star are expelled violently in what is known as a supernova explosion. And the core, which is typically 1.5 times more massive than the sun, gets squeezed into an area of approximately 20 kilometers in size.
Wow.
And forms a neutron star. So neutron stars often rotate very fast, typically 1 to 700 times per second. And during the birth, the magnetic field of the progenitor star gets compressed and magnified on the surface of the neutron star, so that basically you have a giant, strong rotating magnet. So the rotating magnetic field generates strong electric fields, which accelerates particles from the surface of the star. These particles, in turn, give off radiation along the magnetic field axis. Now, if this axis happens to be misaligned with the rotational axis of the star, just like on Earth, this radiation may sweep our line of sight. So what we observe is a pulse once per rotation.
Kind of like a lighthouse.
Exactly, yeah. So this is what we refer to as a pulsar. Now, pulsars are important for many different reasons. Because of their compactness, they are very stable rotators, and the pulses we observe arrive at very regular intervals of time. So this basically means that we can use them as astrophysical clocks to probe their environment, like, for instance, how they move in their orbits if they happen to be in a binary. So, of course, this is not the end of the story, because a pulsar is itself a very, very extreme object. In fact, it's composed of the most extreme type of matter that exists in the universe. Well, just to give you a rough idea, its average density is comparable to that of an atomic nucleus. And at its center, this density is even higher, tens, perhaps 20 times more that of nuclear matter.
Wow.
Furthermore, the internal gravitational fields are extremely strong beyond anything that we can test in our laboratories on Earth or with satellites in the solar system. So these are only but a few of the reasons that make pulsars unique. So we can study them and really learn something fundamental about physics in very extreme environments.
So tell me about this particular pulsar that you focused on this paper. What makes it so unusual in this already unique family of stars?
Okay, so this pulsar has a few properties that make it interesting for several reasons. It has a mass of 2 times the mass of our sun, which is significantly higher than the typical 1.4 solar mass that you may find in a textbook. But the most important thing for us is that this massive pulsar is orbited by another compact object, a white dwarf, in a very tight orbit. So according to Einstein's theory of relativity, but also according to other relativistic theories as well, as the two objects move around each other, the system distorts space-time and loses energy to gravitational waves, which cause the orbit to shrink, so that the two stars come closer and closer and move faster and faster as time goes by, so that the orbital period decays. Now, most of the alternatives to general relativity predict that the properties of the gravitational waves emitted by binary systems are different compared to Einstein's theory. Due to the nonlinear nature of gravity, such deviations may become relevant only in systems like this one that host a massive neutron star, even if there is no measurable effect in the solar system or in less massive neutron stars.
So this system allows you to kind of take a look at general relativity in real life in a system that we can't come close to testing here on Earth.
Exactly. So it allows you to test general relativity in a very strong field regime.
So what would a deviation from general relativity look like? You know, what signs and signals were you looking for from this system?
Okay, so as I said, the properties of the gravitational waves emitted by the system are different depending on what is the correct theory of gravity. But of course, we don't really measure the emission of gravitational waves directly. So to be able to say something about their properties, one basically needs 2 separate pieces of information. So the first is that you need to know the mass of the two objects independently of the gravity theories you want to test.
Hmm.
So for this system, we achieved this by measuring and modeling the optical emission of the white dwarf and also by comparing its orbit to that of the pulsar. So once you know the masses, you can go back to your favorite theory and you can predict what the rate of orbital decay should be and then compare it with the actual one, which you can simply infer by recording the times of arrival of the pulses over a relatively long period of time.
Okay, so you were examining the orbital decay of this particular binary system, the gravitational regime of the system. What did you find? What did it all tell you?
So, well, we found that the rate of orbital decay caused by the emission of gravitational waves is approximately 8.5 microseconds per year, which is exactly what Einstein's theory predicts.
So this confirms general relativity in this very unusual system. Was this a surprise?
It really depends on whom you ask. So there are basically fundamental and well-motivated reasons for studying alternative theories of gravity. Like, for example, we already know that GR is incomplete because it is incompatible with the other great theory of the 20th century, which is quantum mechanics. So in that sense, we know that it cannot be the final answer. But there is a great debate on whether if we can detect any deviation at energy scales that can be brought by our experiments, or if the theory fails, only situations that we have no way of measuring directly, like, for instance, in the very early universe or inside the horizon of a black hole.
Hmm.
So this is more or less the motivation for testing gravity in every possible way. Now, from the philosophical point of view, what I personally find perhaps not surprising, but astonishing, if you like, is that you have this mathematically very elegant theory, which was devised 100 years ago, but yet still manages to survive every single test we have performed.
Right.
So Einstein had no access to information for the kind of systems we study today. He knew nothing about neutron stars, for example. And he basically worked out that the theory to explain the motion of the inner planets in the solar system is a very weak gravitational regime. But yet the theory describes perfectly even the most extreme situations we know of. And this, to me, means that there is really something fundamental about this theory.
So what else does this pulsar tell us, then? Are we able to learn anything else about astrophysics, about the universe?
So there are a number of other interesting things that we can learn from this pulsar. So, as I said before, the properties of matter under extreme densities present in a neutron star core are not very well known. So there are several interesting ideas. For example, it may be that the nuclei dissolve and form fluid made of quarks. But there are only but a handful of methods to tackle this problem observationally. Another thing I would personally like to understand is how the system formed, and also if there are more similar systems in the galaxy, and how many are they, and also what will be the fate of this system in the future. So as the companion star comes closer and closer, the pulsar will start accreting mass again. So if its mass is really close to the maximum allowed mass for a neutron star, it will simply collapse to a black hole. Well, this is really intriguing for me. These are some of the questions which we don't really understand and we don't really know the answer. But of course, this is all part of the fun, right?
Right. Well, John Antoniadis, thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much.
John Antoniadis and colleagues write about how a massive pulsar sheds light on general relativity in a report this week.
In North Korea, if you have a deadly disease like tuberculosis, a limited food supply, questionable medicines, and tight restrictions on travel make shaking the disease a tough proposition. Richard Stone visited North Korea last month and spoke with me about how, despite these challenges, conditions are incrementally improving for TB patients there. He started with the prevalence of the disease.
The TB epidemic in North Korea has caught a lot of scientists by surprise. 20 years ago, North Korea was reporting an annual incidence of fewer than 50 cases per 100,000 people. The latest numbers from 2011 put it at 374 cases per 100,000, which is a sevenfold rise over two decades. And that's about four times the current rates in China and South Korea. What makes North Korea stand out especially is that unlike nearly all other countries with a high TB burden, it doesn't have a big HIV/AIDS problem. The roots of the epidemic in North Korea are devastating famines from 1994 to 98. During this period, which North Koreans call the Arduous March, hundreds of thousands of people, possibly millions, died of starvation. Malnourishment among the survivors allowed tuberculosis to flourish, and chronic malnutrition continues to the present day, and that's what's fueling the epidemic currently. What's especially worrisome, especially to North Korea's neighbors, is the proliferation of drug-resistant TB strains and the fact that many patients suspected to have active infections with drug-resistant strains are not being properly treated.
Hmm. Well, you actually had a chance to visit North Korea, and we'll talk a little bit later about how you got into the country. But one of the spots you went to was a TB reference laboratory in Pyongyang. Can you talk about how that's going to help combat the disease?
This reference laboratory is a rare example of collaboration, scientific collaboration between North Korea and the West. It got going, the roots of the laboratory were in 2007. It's a cooperative effort between Stanford University School of Medicine, a humanitarian organization called Christian Friends for Korea, or CFK, and the North Korean Ministry of Public Health. There was a realization that North Korea was really the only high-burden TB country that did not have a international-level laboratory to give proper diagnosis of TB cases. Work on the laboratory proceeded throughout various crises. You may remember the sinking of the Cheonan, the South Korean naval vessel, in early 2010, the North Korean shelling of Yeompyeong Island in South Korea that killed three civilians later in 2010, various nuclear tests, missile tests, sanctions, new rounds of sanctions, all this greater political environment that was taking place over the past few years. Despite all of that, work on the reference laboratory proceeded, and it opened in October 2010.
And what kind of work will they be doing there, or what are they doing there?
Well, now, thanks to this laboratory, North Korean researchers can diagnose TB cases that are resistant to first-line drug combinations, and that makes it possible to spot patients who need more aggressive therapy. And the lab is soon going to add capacity to screen for extensively drug-resistant TB, also called XDR. These are the worst strains, some of which are nearly impossible to treat. So it's really an important stage in the development of the effort to control TB in North Korea.
So you also were able to visit rural areas in North Korea, to visit rest homes where TB patients were being treated. What was that like?
Well, this was my fifth trip to North Korea, but the first time I got out to see what village life is actually like. And it's pretty grim, I have to say. A lot of these villages don't have very much power. They don't have steady supply of fresh water. People really have serious problems with food shortages still. Since the period of the famines back in the 90s, the food supply has not been very stable. Mm-hmm. What you see in the villages now is people living in pretty deep poverty. They work out in the fields from the early spring, getting the fields ready for the spring sowing, and then later for the fall harvest. After the food is harvested, it's given over to the government. The government rations food back to the people. So it's a pretty difficult life there, despite the fact that they face such hardships there. And I wouldn't even necessarily call this a bright spot, but it's notable that the tuberculosis rest homes where the patients in the rural areas are treated, the rest homes are in relatively good condition. A lot of the buildings have been recently built or fixed up. They are now, thanks to a lot of help from Western organizations, they're getting food donations, which helps boost protein levels in the population. And most of the rest homes now have greenhouses so they can grow food, which augments what they currently can grow. So I think that there is some reason for hope that the TB patients in these rural areas, they can get enough nutrition to be able to be cured. Mm-hmm. Because now the patients which are in the rest homes, a lot of them are put on the proper drug therapies. And this is a matter of the level of expertise increasing and the fact that you do have this new national TB reference laboratory, which is helping to get proper diagnoses, proper medication to these TB patients.
So you mentioned before that this is a broad effort. It's not just the government of North Korea. Can you talk about how humanitarian groups play a role in helping out these rest homes?
Well, they really are playing a critical role because North Korea is one of a handful of countries that, because of the political situation, they can't get a lot of outside support from large foundations. So the role that foundations play in other countries is filled by groups such as the Eugene Bell Foundation, which is working in North Korea now and really currently taking the lead to help patients with the drug-resistant strains. And then you have the Christian Friends of Korea, which was the group I'd spent time with. They've been working in North Korea since 1995, and they've played a big role in improving life for the patients in these rural TB rest homes.
Towards the end of the trip, you actually visited a pediatric ward in Pyongyang. What was that like?
Well, it's pretty heart-wrenching, actually. This pediatric ward is in a poorer section of the city, and I would meet a kid, and I would think, well, this boy, he must be approximately 7 or 8 years old. And then the doctor would say, well, this is a 15-year-old patient.
Oh, wow.
And you're like, wow, this is really a serious problem with the stunting, and kids are not nourished properly. I've seen lots of reports. It was very hard to get accurate figures, but I'd heard, for example, that the North Korean soldiers on average are about a foot shorter than the South Korean soldiers. So you hear these anecdotes about how over the years chronic malnutrition has had such a big effect on the general population there. So this was early spring when I was visiting there. The pediatric ward inside is really freezing cold, so chilly. They don't have proper heating, and these kids are wearing extra layer of these white and blue pinstripe gowns over their clothes. They are homesick because the TB treatment is very intense. It takes a long time. On average, the kids are spending about 4 months at this ward. And the TB drugs are pretty harsh, actually. So it's hard for young bodies to tolerate these drugs. So it's really difficult. You really feel for these kids.
Mm-hmm. During your visit to North Korea last month, tensions were pretty high. Their government was issuing threats, and the U.S. and South Korean military were staging drills off the peninsula. How did you get in, and what was it like there during that tension?
I should emphasize that I had government approval to visit as a journalist. Mm-hmm. But it's such a surreal place. The population had been worked up into a war fever. There was a new mural poster downtown showing a missile bearing down on Capitol Hill.
Oh.
And us Americans were thinking, ooh, this doesn't look too good, does it? And there's a genuine belief that every spring when the U.S. and South Korea holds military drills, there's a genuine belief in the North Korean population that they are about to be attacked. So people are girding for that coming attack. Now, when we were there, we tried to reassure them, you know, from our perspective, this is simply just a military drill. You're not going to be attacked. But they're like, no, don't worry. When the bombs start falling, we will take you into the Pyongyang subway. You'll be safe. So we never felt any hostility directed at us. But clearly, there's an alternative interpretation of the political events, which the North Korean government has, and which we basically had to deal with.
Okay. Well, Richard Stone, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thanks for having me on.
Richard Stone is the international news editor for Science. He writes this week about the state of TB treatment in North Korea. You can also find a slideshow of photos from his trip at www.sciencemag.org/multimedia.
Finally today, I'm Carrie Klein, and I'm speaking with David Grimm, online news editor for Science, about some of the recent stories from our online daily news site. So, Dave, in our first story, how not to treat a disease.
Right, Carrie. Well, this study is a little bit counterintuitive because it suggests that taking two drugs at once may actually be worse for treating the disease than better. This approach, especially taking two antibiotics at once, is called synergistic therapy. And what researchers thought the advantages was that, you know, different drugs attack different parts of a invading microorganism like a bacterium. These drug combinations have been used in everything from treating HIV to MRSA, which is a very highly resistant pathogen that's often acquired in hospitals. But this new study suggests that maybe two drugs at once isn't such a good idea.
Right, because as soon as we start talking about antibiotics, we have to start thinking about bacterial resistance.
Exactly, and that seems to be what happens here. What happens when bacteria evolve resistance is that they find some way to overcome, or members of their population find a way to overcome the drug. And when the drug kills all the other bacteria off, you've got these few bacteria left that are resistant, and they are able to multiply, and all of a sudden your drug doesn't work anymore. Well, it turns out that seems to be happening even more dramatically when you use two antibiotics at once, or at least that's what these researchers have shown. What they did was they took E. coli, which can be a pretty nasty pathogen, and they treated it with two common antibiotics, doxycycline and erythromycin. They basically put these E. coli in a test tube. They added both drugs, and after a day, the drugs seemed to almost completely wipe out the E. coli, which is sort of expected. But what was shocking was the following day, the E. coli experienced this population explosion. All of a sudden, their numbers were up to 500%. Higher than they had been before. So they just really started multiplying really out of control. And at first, the researchers thought they had made some sort of mistake. They repeated the experiment, and they saw the same thing happen again.
And of course, this new population is then much more likely to be resistant to the antibiotics that were used.
It is. And what the researchers found was that just like what happens with one drug, with a couple drugs, it still left a few bacteria left in this population that were really good at fighting these antibiotics. In fact, the bacteria seem to have multiple genes for pumping out these antibiotics. So these antibiotics, you know, get into the bacterial cell and the bacteria usually dies. But there are some bacteria that were very good at just basically pumping this antibiotic right back out again. And those were the ones that survived. And even in the presence of two antibiotics, they just started to thrive after about a day because the antibiotics had wiped out all of their competition. So all of a sudden they had access to all these resources, all of this food that they didn't have access to before. And then they're basically growing out of control because the drugs aren't having any effect on them.
And so the two examples of really nasty diseases that you mentioned earlier, both HIV and MRSA, in which this synergistic method is used quite a bit, I mean, they're really difficult to treat diseases. Are there, if we start not using this method, are there any alternative methods for treating them?
Well, one thing the researchers suggest is instead of hitting bacteria with two drugs at the same time is to alternate the drug. So use one drug one day, wipe out, you know, most of the population, and maybe you have some leftovers that are resistant to that drug, but then you hit it with a different drug the next day, and maybe that will wipe out the remainder. And the idea is sort of mix things up so much that bacteria really don't have a chance to become resistant. That's certainly one possible way to go. You know, all this stuff is in test tubes right now, so it sort of remains to be seen where this is actually happening in the human body.
Right.
But it is a really powerful warning sign for a lot of these multi-drug treatments.
Indeed. Well, on to some slightly better news now. In our next story, we're talking about a new spin on therapy for cancer.
That's right, Carrie. This study has to do with actually using bacteria to fight disease. And the disease we're talking about here is cancer, and specifically pancreatic cancer, which is a really nasty cancer. It's really resistant to treatment. Only about 4% of patients diagnosed with pancreatic cancer survive for 5 years. And that's largely because the disease metastasizes and cancer gets everywhere in the body, and you just can't treat it fast enough before it kills the patient.
All right, so what does this new study on pancreatic cancer involve?
Well, it involves a cancer treating microorganism known as Listeria monocytogenes, if I'm saying that correctly. This is a bacterium that's actually not a very friendly bacterium, and it can cause meningitis, but researchers have also shown that it seems to have an ability to fight cancer as well. In previous studies, researchers have used weakened forms of this bug and included bits of tumor DNA in it. And what that did was when the body saw this bug, it didn't just fight off the bug, but it started to recognize this tumor DNA, and it seemed to have an enhanced ability to prime the immune system to fight cancer. But the researchers actually also noticed that these bacteria weren't just priming the immune system to fight cancer. They actually seemed to fight the cancer itself. In another study, researchers noticed that these Listeria microbes were actually killing cancer cells directly and really having no impact on healthy tissues. And that's what really sparked the new study. Researchers said, you know, if these guys are going after cancer anyways, maybe we can make them even more effective cancer fighters than they were before.
And how do they do that?
What they did was they actually made them radioactive. They modified these Listeria so that they contain a radioactive compound called rhenium-188. And over the course of 16 days, they injected mice that were already infected with a highly metastatic form of pancreatic cancer with these radioactive bacteria. And they saw pretty dramatic results. The radioactive bacteria reduced the number of metastatic cells in the mice by 90% compared to controls. Even the non-radioactive bacteria decreased the metastatic cells by 50%. So it was pretty dramatic results. And like the researchers had seen before, there was very little damage to healthy tissues.
So how is this targeted method different than other forms of radiation?
Well, ordinary radiation isn't terribly specific. I mean, doctors can try to sort of hone in on a particular part of the body, but they have a hard time really getting to the specific cells. And so you tend to have a lot of collateral damage. And what's cool about this therapy is it's sort of like sending a heat-seeking missile into the body because it's really only going after the cancerous cells. That being said, some of the experts consulted for the story still have concerns about putting this radiation into the body because it has to go somewhere, and there's concerns that potentially it could build up in the kidney, for example, and that could cause problems down the line. And again, this is just a rodent study. So although it's promising, the researchers still don't know how well it would work in people and what the potential side effects would be.
Right. And now for something completely different, why babies like to be rocked.
Well, Carrie, what's cool about this study is it shows that there's a lot of commonality between species. In fact, a mother carrying a child in her arms turns out to not be very different than a mother cat grabbing her kitten by the scruff of the neck. The impact on the small animal in both cases is actually surprisingly similar.
So how did a study like this get started in the first place?
Well, this study actually has sort of a fun origin. The lead researcher, who's a neuroscientist in Japan, actually had a newborn baby boy, and she was noticing that, you know, when she carried this baby around, it had a rapidly calming effect on him. Now, that's not really surprising to any parents out there, but what she thought was really cool was how quickly this effect happened. You know, it happens sometimes in as little as 2 to 3 seconds. And she wondered what exactly was happening sort of to the physiology of the baby while she was doing this, and whether this was something that carried over to other animals as well.
So how did she set up a study to look at that?
Well, she set up a study with 12 infants from 1 to 6 months old, and each was left alone in a crib or held by its mother sitting in a chair or carried around the room as the mother walked around. And sometimes these conditions were combined, sometimes they were done separately. What the researchers found was that carried babies cried and squirmed the least, which again is not probably terribly surprising. But they also had the lowest pulse rates, which suggests this is a very calming behavior for them. Those left in the crib were the fussiest, and holding the baby while sitting sort of produced in-between results. The researchers then sort of moved on to mice because they wanted to see, well, you know, is this something that happens in other species as well? Mother mice carry their pups around sort of like mother cats do by grabbing their infants by the nape of their necks in their mouths. And what they found was that just like human babies, when they wired these pups, as they're called, with mini electrodes to track heart rate changes, and they also recorded the ultrasonic vocalizations of these animals, which previous researchers suggested is sort of akin to baby human cries. Hmm. They found that the heart rates of these animals plunged, the vocalizations stopped, the animals became passive, just sort of like human babies do.
So there were two elements of what actually helped calm these baby animals. You know, one element was carrying it, and the other one was motion.
Exactly, exactly.
So why do the scientists think that this in particular would have been hardwired so much in humans and in mice?
Well, what the researchers suspect is that this might have evolved as a way for mothers to get their newborns out of danger. Obviously, if you've got a baby that's thrashing around when you're carrying it and trying to walk away or maybe even run away with it, it's going to be much harder for you to be able to do that. Whereas if your baby becomes very quiet and passive, especially as you're in motion, that could potentially be an evolutionary advantage that helps both the mother but also the newborn effectively escape to safety.
Wow, how interesting. So what else have we had on the site this week?
Well, Carrie, for Science Now, we've got a story about the populating of Australia. Who were the first Australians and how many were there? Also a story about a baby turtle robot and how that is shedding light on how baby turtles navigate very tricky beach sand. For Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got a story about the patenting of human genes and the controversy around that. And finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, this week's chat is about the Anthropocene. This is this controversial idea that we have entered a new geological age, what's known as the Age of Man. So be sure to tune in for a video chat on that. And next week's chat is going to be about the Chinese H7N9 virus that's been making the news lately. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Great. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Carrie.
David Graham is the online news editor for Science. You can check out all of our news at news.sciencemag.org, including daily stories from Science Now, Science Policy from Science Insider, and Science Live, live chats on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time. And that concludes the April 26th, 2013 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Sarah Crespi. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.